Ichabod. It was never subtle. I'd cake on eyeliner and rub it in with my pinky so it looked like it had been there for days. I never wanted anyone to ever ask, "Are you wearing makeup?" That's what I feared most, talking about it or having to justify it. That's what made me nervous. I never wanted to be the topic of conversation, so I never gave people a place to even start. Even today, I'm never really what anyone would call appropriate. If I had to, I'd describe my current personal style as someone doing a pretty good job at handling a very bad day. I'll never fully fit in. When I started working on TV, I'd get all these crazy invites to these glossy, strict dress code only parties, and I'd show up wearing actual garbage. I looked like I had just come from a bachelor party, but one that started 2 days earlier. I'd wear the weirdest, most destroyed and wrinkled outfit I could put together just to see if they'd let me in. And when they did, once inside, drinking their free booze, I'd cheers to 16-year-old me. Being over the top, or flamboyant for lack of a better word, and making myself a target gave me something to fight against, gave me an enemy. Dealing with judgy strangers allowed me to push my own shit deeper and deeper. It was a perfect distraction. Managing ego with crazy insecurity is a contradiction most of us live with. For me, it's every day, every minute, always has been. Growing up in a small town, you quickly realize that how you treat people matters. No one was anonymous. You couldn't be an asshole to someone and get away with it. If I was a dick to the guy who ran the corner store when my dad stopped there to buy smokes on his way home after work, he'd hear all about it. How you treat people matters. That's the lesson. So there I was, polite, pretty, and clueless, desperate to be famous and desperate to fit in. You need to know all this so you understand why what happened next happened. This is the story of when I was definitely almost molested by Sebastian Bach's manager. It was around 1989, and my friend drove us out of town to go to the record store, Sunrise Records at Stone Road Mall. I always knew what I wanted to get before we even left the house, but I'd still spend hours in there just flipping through cassettes and listening to whatever the clerk decided to spin, while fantasizing what it would be like to have my own album in a place like this, while some other kid, just like me, came in to spend their allowance on something I made. I was cruising the aisles with a Skid Row tape in my hand when this guy walks up and asks, "Are you a fan?" In my head, I was like, "Obviously, you dumb shit. Look at me." Sebastian Bach, the singer of Skid Row, was my style icon. I mumbled. This guy was older, like my father's age. Short-sleeved dress shirt tucked in, dad jeans, thick glasses. He looked like he could have been a pen salesman or a Radio Shack model. "You like Skid Row? You a fan?" he said. "I'm asking because I manage him, Sebastian Bach." There was a part of me that wanted to call bullshit right away, but I knew Sebastian was from a small town not far from where I grew up, so I gave this guy 2 seconds of my attention. Just as I was about to shoot back with, "Oh yeah, how long you," he jumped in with, "You know he's gay, right?" I was stunned. Not surprised, but stunned. As someone who lived off every piece of information I could get my hands on about my favorite bands, I was enthralled and intoxicated by the fact that I had dirt that nobody knew. Secrets. So I responded with a very polite, "Fuck off, man." To which he immediately replied, "You look like him." He paused and then added, "You have great hair. He'd love that. He's really into that." That was it. That's all it took. Up to that point, no adult had ever acknowledged the way I looked with anything other than, "Cut your hair, no, or not with my daughter." This guy was into it, and he was Sebastian Bach's manager, and now I believed him. At this point, I was losing my shit over the idea that Sebastian Bach might be into me, even though I was pretty sure he wasn't gay, and even more than sure I wasn't. But for some reason, the idea that I might be his type was blowing my fucking mind. What do you even do with that? The guy introduced himself. "I'm Mick Nickel, keeper of the case." He laughed and waited for me to pick up the bait. I must have taken a beat too long because he said, "I'm closer to him than anyone in the world, and I'm in charge of his case." I took it. His case? Every time he's with a guy, Sebastian cuts a piece of their hair off, wraps one end with an elastic, and puts it in a briefcase. He takes this case around the world with him, with us. In my head, I was like, wait, what? You're fucking with me. Gross. But for some reason, maybe because I didn't want the gossip to stop, or maybe I was enjoying feeling like I fit into this story and this world, flattered that this dude who knew Sebastian Bach was into the way I looked, I replied with, cool. The next 5 minutes were a blur. Mick went into this long, involved story about how he discovered Sebastian Bach, how he got him hooked up with the right people, and how he landed Skid Row their first record deal. He knew everything, dates, places, names, and every detail I'd read and already memorized from the metal magazines I devoured. I started to think I just got discovered. The 80s were full of stories of young women being discovered in American malls who went on to become supermodels. Their discoveries couldn't have been any less weird than this one. Mick asked if I had a demo tape, which I did. I always carried it with me on cassette in the top left pocket of my purple jean jacket. He then asked if I wanted to head out to the parking lot, to his truck, to hear the new Skid Row album before anyone else. He said I'd love it, and afterwards we could listen to my demo. This was one of the first times my insecurity did battle with my ego. I wanted him to like me, but I knew as soon as he heard my demo, I'd be done. It wasn't that good. I told Mick that I couldn't head out to the parking lot, but I would call him. He said that he was right out front, and he could tell me within minutes if I had what it took. He pushed harder. Just come on out. Follow me. Let's go. No big deal. No, I really need time. I was nervous. If this was my one shot, I wanted to make it count. I wanted time to work on it. I also knew my buddy had to get the car home in an hour because his dad worked nights. Mick took a long pause, then said, too bad. I bet you're perfect. Okay, call me tomorrow night at 9. Play it for me over the phone. In that moment, I sort of remember hearing him say, play with me over the phone, but I knew what he meant. We shook hands, he handed me his card, and he walked out. I was so unbelievably pissed off with myself. Why hadn't I just gone to his truck? I'd blown my one chance. I worked all night on my demo. I woke up the next morning and headed to school armed with the story of a lifetime. At first, it started as a whisper, which eventually became a scream. I was the guy who told anyone who'd listen that Sebastian Bach was a perv who cut chunks of guys' hair off after sex, and that he had a guy on the payroll whose job it was to travel the world with him, taking care of his briefcase of gross souvenirs. This never made me think any other way about Sebastian Bach. It was rock and roll, and in some weird way, it gave me a connection to him. I was in on a secret that maybe only a few dozen other people were in on. Okay, probably hundreds. At 9 that night, I called Mick, the manager, from the home phone. I had everything set up. The perfect demo, the perfect speaker to play it through at the perfect distance from the receiver. I know this because earlier that day, I called two friends and did a distance test with them over the phone. I'd sat there moving the receiver back and forth, closer then farther from the speaker, until they'd yell, "Good, right there!" I was set. The phone rang once before a woman picked up and yelled, "Hello, it's late. Who's this?" The other end of the line sounded like chaos. There was yelling, and a TV was blaring so loudly that I could barely make out what she was saying. "Hi, my name's Roz. I was supposed to call Mick at 9. "Who?" she yelled back. "Roz." "No, who?" she yelled back. "Mick," I shouted. There was a super long pause, then I heard her mumble, "I don't know, maybe it's for you." Another voice jumped on the line. "Yeah, who's this?" "Roz," I said. "We met at sunrise. You said to call. My demo." "Yeah," he said. "What?" This was a disaster. He was clearly not at the office, and I could hear ice tapping the side of a glass as he took a sip of his drink. "It's Roz," I repeated. "You said you wanted to hear my demo. I'm good to go, man." "Yeah, call me back in 5 minutes," he said. Then click. Dial tone. I waited 5 and called back. When Mick picked up, there was silence. No TV. No yelling, no ice hitting the side of a glass. "Thanks for this," I said. "You ready?" "I'm alone now, but I need to hear you. Press play on the tape, sure, but I need to hear you sing live. Sing for me. Singing live was something I'd never done. I'd never had an audience of anyone, let alone a big-time manager. I hit play, put the phone down, and just went for it. I sang the whole thing, a song I wrote. When I was done, my hands were shaking. I was sweating. I reached down with both hands to pick up the receiver. As I put it back up to my ear, I could tell the line was dead. Mick was gone. No dial tone, no nothing. I called back, and nothing. I called again, and nobody picked up. I was pissed, fucking livid, devastated. I had definitely and totally blown my one chance. Why didn't I just go out to his fucking truck at the mall? I left my room and went in to talk to my dad. I told him the whole story, everything. The only question Pops had was, "Did you go out to this guy's car?" "No, Pops," I told him again. "Okay," he said, "give me his card." At that time, we didn't have call logs or redial, so that card was the only place Mick's number existed. I never told this story to anyone. I was too embarrassed. I blew my over-the-phone audition with a guy who carries hunks of men's hair for a living. But for years, I did tell people what I heard about Sebastian Bach. I retold that part of the story to anyone who would listen. Given how fast gossip traveled before Google, I'd say there's probably a few thousand people in this world who still believe that Sebastian Bach cuts his young male lover's hair and keeps it in his luggage. Even when I saw a picture of his wife years later, I thought it was all bullshit. Of course he'd have a beautiful wife. She was the perfect cover. I felt bad for the guy that he couldn't be the freak that he wanted to be. I felt worse that I blew my audition and would probably never get the chance to tell Sebastian that. In my head, Mick hung up because I wasn't good enough. I'm sure my dad felt different. I never really thought about what actually happened in those 24 hours. I never tried to analyze it. It was a painful memory of inadequacy that I filed away. Once I realized that I wasn't good enough, along with my growing stage fright, I abandoned the idea of being a performer altogether. I still loved playing and writing songs, but I was never going to stand on a stage. I think that's what drew me to TV and radio. You can have a massive audience, but you'll never have to see a single one of them. For most of my 20s, I kept behind the scenes. I was a writer and a producer, far away from the spotlight. I didn't take my first on-air job until I was 30. The cool thing about interviewing celebs for a living is that I've talked to most of the people I had posters of up on my wall when I was a kid. A lot of them let you down, but sometimes they surprise you. If you told me at 15, when I was 30-something, I'd get a chance to sit in front of Sebastian Bach and ask him anything I wanted, everything I've always wanted to, I would have died. But that's what happened. Sebastian Bach was in town promoting a new album, tour, or book. I don't remember. I hadn't thought about my run-in with his manager in a long time. I hadn't told the story about the briefcase in even longer. The interview was wonderful. Sebastian Bach was charming and honest and humble. I brought my high school yearbook to show him how much I looked like him when I was a kid, to show him how much of a fan I've always been. As we were wrapping up and the crew were taking down the lights and unhooking us, I asked if he still worked with Mick Nickel. "Who?" Sebastian asked. "Mick Nickel. He was your manager 20 years ago." "Nah, man, not me, not mine. Never heard of him." I was sort of pissed because I really looked forward to telling him the hilarious story of blowing my over-the-phone audition. How could he not remember? Surely he'd remember the guy he paid to be in charge of his... Fuck. That was one of the most devastating realizations I ever had. It wasn't until that moment that I realized how dangerous the situation had been. I sat there in front of Sebastian Bach while he flipped his hair around and held my high school yearbook, frantically putting all the pieces together like Chaz Palminteri at the end of The Usual Suspects. Fuck, I thought again, and fuck was right. I don't know what my dad did with Mick's business card, but I never called the guy again, and my dad never brought it up again. I regretted for years not going out to that guy's truck because I thought it would have been my big break. but most likely it would have been something very different. And it definitely almost was. I'm still not 100% sure my dad didn't kill that guy. And I'm not even joking. Shock and awe. January 17th, 1991, 2 days after my brother's 19th birthday, my family, like every family, sat in front of the TV and watched Operation Desert Storm unfold live on CNN. For anyone my age who grew up in this part of the world, this was our first real experience with war and what it looked like. It looked like MTV. It was a show. I remember all the excitement and pageantry really pissing my dad off. At the time, nobody knew anything. Nobody knew the entire thing was only going to last a month or so. This was the first time I ever turned on the television and saw the word war flash across the screen. It was scary and confusing, and I remember firing questions at my dad like he was some sort of expert. I was trying to make sense of it. What happens now? How do they win? What are they fighting over? My pops did his best to answer the best he could while trying to mask his absolute rage. He knew what he was watching. He'd seen this all before. He'd lived it. What happens if there's a draft? I asked. That was the last question of the night and the easiest one for him to answer. You won't have to worry about that, he said, shaking his head, clenching his fists without taking his eyes off the TV. They won't do that again. Not here anyway. But if they did, there's no way. There's no way you're going off to fight someone else's war. You're not going to die for whatever lie started this shit show. I'd take a baseball bat to your knee, both of you, you and your brother. Your left knee, you'd still be able to drive a car, maybe not a standard, but you'd never make it through the physical, let alone boot camp. I'd make sure of that. I'd always had a pretty good idea of what my dad was willing to do to keep me safe, but this was the first time I realized what he was willing to do to keep me alive. My parents never hit us. I never got spanked, slapped, or anything else. They were never into violence, but they sure as fuck were into fear. Right around this time, I was like every other teenage boy who pushed the limits and boundaries while carving out a little independence. My dad was always cool. He understood young men and gave me every inch I fought for with a casual combo of compassion and terror. I was leaving the house one night, heading out with friends a little later than I normally would. There was no lecture about curfews, rules, or respect. Pops didn't know what me and my shithead friends were going to get up to, and he didn't care because it was never going to happen. Let me tell you something, he said to me right before I left. Let me tell you what happens if I ever get a call to pick you up from the police station. First off, make sure you call me. Don't ever be afraid to call me. I'll come down, stand at the desk with all the other dads picking up their sons, and I'll be the nicest of them all, cooler than cool. The other dads will think I'm crazy. When they walk you out, I'll give you the biggest hug you've ever had, like we haven't seen each other in years. I'll pay for your fine and walk you out of the cop shop with my arm around you, tell you I love you, all that stuff. But as soon as we clear those doors, be prepared to defend yourself, okay? I was never afraid of being hit by my dad, but I was terrified that one day I'd have to fight my dad, and that is a whole world of difference. My mom was the same. She was terrifying in her own wonderful way. When I was old enough to start using public washrooms by myself, maybe 5 or 6, she tried to street-proof me. Before I went in alone that very first time, I don't remember what I was thinking, but I was probably a little nervous and maybe a little proud. I was a kid. Most moms would have said something like, go in, do your business, and come right out. I'll be right here. What my mom said was, don't talk to anyone and never fully face the wall. There was a little boy on the other side of Montreal last year who went in to go pee, and a man walked right up behind him, reached around him, and cut his pecker off with a pair of scissors. Then he left with it too. He put it right in his pocket and walked out. They never found the man or that poor boy's penis. Okay, honey? She kissed me on the top of my head, spun me around by my shoulders, and pointed me towards the door. Go ahead. I'll be right here when you get out. That's fucked up, right? Like, why would you tell a kid that story? I'm not sure it was even true. I'm actually pretty positive it's not, but how do you fact check that? I've often thought about looking it up to finally call her out on it, but there is just no way I'm typing any of the keywords from that story into Google. Even into my late teens, I was still leaning so far into a urinal, creating a perfect sealed barrier between my body and the porcelain that I have to stand with my shirt under the hand dryer for 5 minutes to dry out the spots of condensation and other guys' piss before I could leave. But I always made it out with my penis. Smells like team spirit. I'm pretty sure I'm the only kid to be kicked off a high school basketball team for wearing too much jewelry. Basketball was another one of those times where people just assumed things about me, thought I was someone I wasn't, put me in a position to fail, then blame me when I did. I didn't try out for the team, never showed interest in the team, but wound up on the team as its star player. Other than gym class, I had never touched a basketball in any sort of competitive way, let alone played in an actual game. I didn't know the positions or the rules. I was awkward and skinny, and I didn't own a pair of running shoes that fit, and none of the girls I went to school with had ever seen me in shorts. The tops of my thighs were covered in burn marks, and I hated my legs. This was a problem, but there I was. In my last year of high school, I had late period lunch around 2, so the cafeteria was usually empty. In the nicer months, I'd always go home for lunch, barbecue a couple burgers, smoke a few of my parents' cigarettes, and suntan on the roof of the house. I'd climb up on the side of the deck, put down a towel right there on the shingles, cover my chest and face in vegetable oil from the pantry, and get a little color. I wouldn't even pour it into my hand. I'd lie back and drizzle a line of it from the top of my jeans to my neck. Then I'd rub it in with both hands from my belly button to my forehead. I'd bake myself, and I could do all that in less than an hour. At this point, I still had my long hair, but was much less glam than I'd been years before. The world was changing fast. Everything I thought was cool was suddenly a joke. My idols were now clowns. My taste in music was outdated and laughable. That was the year grunge happened, and I was not ready. For everything Nirvana stood for at the time, the rage, the passion, and the genius, I don't think Kurt Cobain's influence on fashion gets enough credit. I think we should talk more about that. Not only did Nirvana show up and destroy everything I loved musically, but overnight, preppy prom queens who smelled like cotton candy, who'd spend hours on their hair and makeup before class, with bra straps showing and skirts short enough to get a letter sent home to their parents, were showing up in baggy jeans and their father's old flannel shirts with unwashed, uncombed hair. It was incredible to see. I've still never seen anything like it. Never before has one individual who never wanted to be an example of anything, let alone fashion, had such impact on the way teenagers saw themselves. Within a month, my high school looked like Project Grungeway, and Cobain was their god. I hated Nirvana. I was not grungy. Far from it. My whole life, I was shy, pretty, and constantly mistaken for a girl, and I could always tell when it was about to happen. I remember as a kid being at the mall and fighting for space at the perfume counter while Christmas shopping for my mom, when a man cut in front of me. He was a bit of a dick and shoved me to the side. The woman behind the counter watched this all go down and put her hand out, waving it back and forth in that mom way with one finger extended right up in the guy's face. "No, no, no. This young lady was ahead of you, sir. Sorry." This happened often, and I never corrected anyone. It would have been easy to just say, "Thanks, but boy," but I never did. It was easier to just go with it. It was less embarrassing. I was far cooler with people thinking I was a girl than I was with them wondering why I choose to look so much like one. So I never set them straight. Even on the phone, I was one of those boys whose voice changed way late. I'd answer a call, and the person on the other end would say something like, "Oh, hi, miss. Is your mom or dad home?" I'd say nothing and just hand the phone over to my mom all the time. Grunge did one thing, though. It normalized facial hair. Back then, facial hair wasn't cool. We were young men raised by fathers who peaked in the late 60s or mid-70s. Our dads had mustaches, big, thick, gnarly ones, the kind you'd see in porno, the kind we'd make fun of. Nobody ever wanted to look like their dad, and my old man had a legendary mustache. But suddenly, in the early 90s, goatees, soul patches, and beards were the shit, and the girly, makeup-covered, smooth, glam rock faces were out. Facial hair was cool, and this was a way for me to finally look like a guy. The first day I could grow something on my face, I did. It was a flag, a badge, a way for me to end the confusion about what exactly I was. I've had some sort of facial hair ever since then. I haven't been fully clean-shaven in over 30 years. I never had that moment with my pops where he taught me how to shave. Never stood in the bathroom, both of us, lathering up in front of the mirror. By the end of high school, the only two holdovers from my glam years were that my toenails were always painted, always something fun and bright, never black. Goth kids painted their shit black, and I was not goth. The other thing, the last little bit of that glam rock kid I used to be, was jewelry. Just before I started grade 9, years before, I started collecting bracelets. Most of them were cheap metal bangles from head shops or were given to me by girls I dated who'd add to my collection. I never took them off, ever. And because I'd had them on for years while I was still growing, I wouldn't have been able to take them off even if I wanted to. My hands grew too big, so these were permanent. These were my thing. My wrist underneath was always some shade of green, and if I ever raised my hand to ask a question in class, I sounded like sleigh bells. So one afternoon in grade 12, I was walking back through the empty caf coming in from the smoking pit. Back then, schools let kids smoke cigarettes in a designated area. This was on school property and close enough to the side door that you could dip out for a quick one while on a bathroom break from class if you needed to. I was walking one way, smelling like cigarettes and vegetable oil, and our gym coach was coming at me. We really didn't know each other, but he stopped me. Coach was a cool yet crusty younger teacher, but we had never talked after grade 10 when I didn't have to take gym anymore. "How tall are you?" he asked as we passed each other. 6'3"-ish. "Why?" I answered. "You know we could use you, right?" "For what?" I asked. "On the team. Basketball." "To do what?" I was so confused. "Basketball," he explained while sounding just as confused as I did. This is the moment I should have politely said no, thanked him, and moved on. This is when I should have told him I knew absolutely nothing about basketball, but I didn't. "Do you have gym clothes here?" "I have track pants, yeah," I said. "Swing by for practice in an hour. We'll get you out there." Being that tall at that age, I got mistaken for a basketball player almost as much as I got mistaken for a girl. This was constant and almost comical. But like those other times, I'd never correct anyone. I'd actually avoid anything that had to do with basketball just to avoid the embarrassment of having no clue what I was doing. I'm not going to lie. The first practice felt great. I mean, I was the only kid in sweatpants, and I wore my socks on the court because I didn't have runners in my locker, but I did all the things. The coach told me to stand under the net, and for 45 minutes, I just stuffed guys. Anytime anyone came in for a layup, I'd stand on my tiptoes, put that big, jangly, bracelet-covered arm up, and shut them down. Basketball was easy. I'd never been on a school team before, and this whole thing felt really good. I should have kept it to myself, but I went home and told Pop that I was on the squad. My dad was just as much of a sports fan as he was music fan, which wasn't much. He'd watched the odd hockey game with me, but didn't know who the players were or who had the best shot at winning. It was just a way for us to hang out. Hockey wasn't fun for him, but time together was. He was pumped for me, and we high-fived when I told him how I spent all practice shutting guys down and how the coach said the other teams were going to shit themselves when they saw me walk onto the court. I may or may not have told my dad that coach said I was their secret weapon, even though I'm 100% sure coach never used those words while talking to me. Once again, this was ego doing battle with insecurity. My high school was small, so when it came to sports, music, or drama, everyone just sort of did everything. We didn't really have jocks. Everyone got to play. 2 days after that first practice, I played my first game. I had my uniform, tied up my hair into a giant ponytail, wrapped 2 bandanas around my left wrist to hide all my bracelets, and I walked out with the team. It was an away game, and other schools always made us eat shit for everything. People just hated Acton. We were the trashy skids who all other schools agreed to hate, and I looked like their mascot. When we walked onto the court, the gym went silent. There I was, 6'3"-ish, and beside me was James. James was born with dwarfism. He was a little person. He was a kid we'd always gone to school with. I stayed far away from sports, so I hadn't really thought about how other people would react to seeing him on a basketball court. And now he was standing beside me, a giant with a high ponytail and a pink scrunchie. The other team and their fans had no clue what to even do with this, so they whispered and laughed, which is something I was very used to, and I'm more than sure James was too. Neither of us let on like we cared. I'm not sure James even did care. The first 5 minutes of that game were a disaster. I didn't know where to stand, what the plan was, who to pass the ball to, or what a foul was. I knew nothing about basketball. In those first few minutes, I was double and triple teamed by their defense. They assumed I was a killer and tried to shut me down, but soon realized I was a huge waste of resources. James was 10 times the basketball player I was, so for the rest of the first quarter, the other team just let me awkwardly run up and down the court like a baby giraffe. I wasn't a threat. I was an embarrassment to the game. I remember the coach saying, "What are you doing, man?" To which I just answered, "I don't know." He seemed as pissed as he was confused. Before the end of the half, one of my bandanas came loose and my bracelet started to show. The ref blew his whistle and walked me over to the bench. "Those have to go," he told my coach. "They're dangerous. Someone is going to get hurt with those. Take them off," he said to me. "They don't come off," I told them. Coach grabbed my wrist and started digging his finger under the other bandana to loosen it up. "Get rid of these now," he told me. "No, I can't. They don't come off," I repeated. "Cut them off," he snapped. Those bracelets and my hot pink toenails were the last two things that made me me. Everything was changing so fast, and here I was trying to be someone I wasn't. Again. "Get that shit off or you're gone," the coach told me. "Okay," I thought, and I started to walk over to the bench to take a seat when he grabbed my shoulder and spun me around. "No," he said, "get your shit and go. You're done." I knew he really wasn't mad about the bracelets. This wasn't about jewelry. He was pissed at himself. He'd been wrong about me. I never wanted to be the star or anything. I'd never been on a team, didn't want to be singled out, and hated taking orders. Sure, I had one good practice, but I was a shit basketball player. I was tall, and that's all I was. He'd thought I was something that I wasn't, and I made him look like a fool, even though it was me who just got kicked out of a high school basketball game for excessive jewelry wearing. In my high school, being chosen valedictorian was more of a popularity contest than something you earned. It wasn't based on grades or your volunteer work or how many awards you had won. It was an open vote, democratic to a fault, and anyone could get nominated. Anyone could win. The election was student-run, but teacher-supervised. If enough people wrote your name down on a piece of paper on vote day, you'd be the kid who'd get to send off the senior class with words of wisdom and encouragement and the confidence to chase their dreams and crush their goals, just like in the movies. On nomination day, I was as shocked as anyone to see my name on the shortlist. It was me and three girls, three really smart girls who were all going off to high-end universities. Three girls who had spent their entire high school careers preparing for a moment like this. Me, I was just popular. I think people wrote my name down, hoping I'd get up there, shotgun a beer, yell, "Acton High seniors rule!" Throw my fist in the air, crush the can on my head, and walk off to thunderous applause. That's what guys like me did in the movies. I could do that. I had never comfortably been on a stage in front of people, and I certainly wasn't equipped to be anything close to inspiring, but I could make a fool of myself. I could make people laugh. Election day was an absolute scandal, a shit show, a screw job to end all screw jobs. When all the ballots had been counted and recounted, I was chosen by my peers to be their valedictorian by 4 votes. I won because 4 more people in that school wanted to see me get up there and say some crazy shit than the ones who wanted to be inspired. Carrie Ann deserved it, and we all knew it. 3 anonymous teachers were in charge of overseeing and validating the vote. Apparently, 4 votes was just too close to call, so they hit a hard pause on the entire thing. I hadn't even celebrated yet. I didn't get a chance to tell my parents, but before the end of the day, there was going to be a revote. I don't know what exactly they were hoping for, but I assumed it was any result that wasn't me. In the 2 or 3 hours between votes, I started to take things seriously. It really hit me. I wasn't sure I wanted to be the guy who flashed the crowd, did a shot, and walked off. I didn't want to do the thing they all hoped I would. I didn't want to just be funny, and I certainly didn't want to let anyone down. I skipped 2 periods and sat in the smoking pit just outside the cafeteria and played this out in my head over and over. I barely passed grade 11 English, didn't take any poetry or creative writing classes, and hadn't got a grade above 60% on a book report in my whole life. How do you write a speech when you have nothing to say? I sat there, chain smoking, feeling the exact same way I did when I'd sit naked with my guitar in my bedroom trying to force myself to cry, looking for something inside of me I knew I'd never find. I wanted to write a great speech the same way I wanted to write a great ballad. I wanted to be heartbreaking, thoughtful, inspiring, and motivating. I wanted it to be the thing people would remember, the kind of speech you see go viral on YouTube today. I needed this. I needed to go out this way. I wanted to surprise people. I wanted to stand there, on stage, with an audience, validated and vulnerable. The recount happened, and I lost, by 2 votes. And it was official this time. There was no way they were ever going to give this to me, and nothing anyone said was going to turn this around, no matter how unfair it seemed. This was a screw job. It was never going to be me. The 2nd vote, by the way, would have been even closer had I not voted for Carrie Ann. She deserved it, and I had nothing to say anyway. These were people who thought I was something that I wasn't, and there was no way I was going to make a fool of myself to prove them right. I didn't want to be put into another position to fail and then get blamed for it again when I did. I'm still not sure who those 3 anonymous teachers were who were in charge of the whole thing, but I bloody well guarantee you, one of them was that basketball coach. 2. Bridges and Tunnels. 18 going on 19. College was going to be fucking awesome. It was 1993, and I spent a good chunk of that last year of high school sending off letters to UCLA, USC, University of Miami, Boston College, and anywhere else that had a media program requesting admissions forms. This would be my total reinvention. I didn't have big dreams of good grades and graduating with honors, but I knew damn well I could be a legendary student. I wanted to be Rob Lowe in St. Elmo's Fire, tortured and lost, sitting on the roof of a frat house with a saxophone, a cigarette, and knockoff Ray-Bans, partying half-naked with girls who were also half-naked, while chugging beer and dancing around to Def Leppard. I wanted football games and pep rallies, drunk, popular, and fallen in love, having my goddamn heart broken. I could be that guy. I was that guy. None of that happened. My high school grades left me with very few college options. Actually, they left me with just 1 option, the radio broadcasting program at Humber College, about a 45-minute drive from the town I grew up in. I applied to exactly 1 school. I never wanted to be a DJ. I only ever wanted to be an entertainer. I wanted an audience. Humber had a decent, well-respected radio program, and more importantly, they had dorms, which meant I wouldn't have to live at home with my mom and dad and commute in every day. A school with a dorm was my top priority, and these were single rooms, no roommate. They had cable TV, you got your own phone, and you could smoke. I certainly didn't get accepted because of my grades or my in-person audition, which involved me reading an old traffic report along with a made-up commercial script for chicken tenders in front of the entire admissions team. My voice was a little deeper at this point, but even still, 2 weeks before my audition, I remember chain-smoking cigarette after cigarette and screaming into my pillow at night, trying to destroy my vocal cords just enough to give me a great voice. None of that helped. I got accepted because I was the only person in that room who had real-life experience inside an actual radio station. Every Saturday night during my last year of high school, I'd sit on a bus for 2 hours and go and work in Toronto for free at a rock station, the biggest one in the country. I'd run the mixing board for the DJ, load up the CDs, organize the commercial carts, and press play on the reel-to-reel machine if we were running something off tape. The studios were incredible, state-of-the-art, and there was a punching bag and a grand piano in the lobby. The piano was just for show, but the punching bag was set up because the general manager got tired of the hot-headed sports reporter punching holes in the wall every time he got into an argument with the boss. Or at least that's the story they told. The halls were lined with autographed gold and platinum records from every band I loved. There was a kick-ass jock lounge with a purple felt pool table and a wraparound balcony on the 25th floor. Before that, I'd never met an actual DJ, and these dudes were gnarly. Old-school jocks with big voices, big egos, making big money. But here's the crazy part. They all really seemed to hate what they did. Don't get me wrong, they loved their own voices, and getting paid to sit around listening to Led Zeppelin was cool too. But my God, did they hate the audience. If you called into a radio station, to them, you were a loser, a fucking idiot. They'd call you a prize pig or a Lugan, whatever that meant. If you were a kid who called in to request a song, forget about it. Those assholes would keep you on hold for 20 minutes and then just dump all the lines all at once, hanging up on you and everyone else. To them, this was hilarious. To me, it was heartbreaking because I used to be one of those kids. The day my dad helped me move into my college dorm was very much like the movies. That weekend, I remember my mom stepped back a bit and let Pops have these moments with me. Nobody on my dad's side of the family had ever gone to college before. My brother started the year before I did, but he was still living at home. So I was the first Weston to ever go off to college. My parents sold their house and moved into a rental to make sure we could afford it. After Pop set up my room and hooked up my TV, I laid out the sheet set Mom got me for the single bed that I was way too big for. My dad grabbed me, pulled me in. He didn't say much, but he gave me one of those hugs of his, the best kind. "This is an incredible opportunity," he whispered to me. "I'm proud of you. You got this." "Yeah, Pop, I got this." He was right. This was an incredible opportunity. So I did my absolute best to fuck it all up. I didn't know much about college. Hell, I didn't know much about anything. But I certainly didn't know that you had to take English courses in order to pass. Like actual English classes with book reports where spelling counts. I honestly thought I'd walk into radio school and spend all my time learning how to make pro-level prank phone calls while coming up with a killer radio name like Tarzan Dan or Brother Jake. For 2 weeks, I tried to make Roz Boswood happen, or Roz Boz for short. That did not happen because it was stupid. I wanted classes on humor, improv, storytelling, and contract negotiations. I wanted to spend my days writing jokes and my evenings screaming into my pillow trying to perfectly destroy my voice. This was not that. There was no course called How to Be Howard Stern 101. On the first day of class, our English teacher assigned a huge project right out of the gate. This was less of a test and more of a challenge. She knew nobody wanted to take the class, so she made it simple. Anyone who gets above 95 on this essay doesn't have to take this course, and you'll never see me again. That was it. It was that easy. I worked my ass off on that essay. For 5 days, I spent every minute in the library, skipped meals, and watched zero TV. I crushed it. It was a literal masterpiece. I'd never felt so confident about anything in my entire life. The following Wednesday, I walked back into that English class and yelled, "You ready for this?" as I one-arm slammed that thing down on the teacher's desk. "I look forward to never seeing you again," I said with full snark and a half wink. "Same," she replied. I got 21%. I'd never seen anything like that before. My essay was so marked up, crossed out, and pulled apart, it looked like redacted FBI testimony. That was, however, the last time I ever saw that teacher again. I never went back. Everyone just assumed I aced it, and I never said otherwise. I was a kid who had incredible confidence, but pretty low self-esteem. I've always believed that when you're young, those two things are built in two very different ways. Confidence comes from people telling you you're great. Self-esteem is built by doing things that are great, accomplishments. I'd never done any great things. I had all the confidence in the world, but would always lower the expectations I had for myself just to avoid failure. Nobody ever saw me fail at anything. I couldn't handle that. Those first few months of college were different, though. I was now 19 and could already feel the shine rubbing off me. My confidence took hit after hit, and my self-esteem was non-existent. I was irrelevant and invisible. It's not that people started to expect less of me. It's just that nobody cared. I wasn't ready for any of this, emotionally or otherwise. I felt lost. I missed my brother, and even doing my best in the classes that I did like, I was never going to be good enough. For the first little while, I really did try hard to take part, to make the best of it. I made a few good friends, talked a lot of shit, did the Thursday pub crawls, and discovered that Jack Daniels and I do not mix. The thought, though, of having to stand out or impress anyone was killing me. I didn't have that thing, that spark that other people in my class had. I still had nothing to say. It was cheaper for us to eat lunch at the strip club up the street than it was to eat in the dorm cafeteria. Giant bowl of spaghetti, garlic bread, and a large Coke for $6. You just couldn't beat those prices, so that's what we did. A couple of days a week, a few of us would hop the bus for two stops to head up to the Manhattan Strip. This was always mid-afternoon, so transitioning from the blazing fall sun to a super dark, neon and smoke-filled club always felt weird. Oddly, a suburban strip club in an industrial area at 2 in the afternoon is not the happiest place on earth. These girls were all day shift dancers who never expected much from anyone, certainly not from a gang of poor college kids who were only there for the garlic bread. But we were always respectful. We'd clap after each of their understandably uninspired routines, and we'd all tip the bartender $1 each on our way out, even though none of us were drinking. Every other customer in there was there alone, solo tables. They'd smoke a few cigarettes and nurse the same beer for an hour while making small talk with the dancers. Nobody who walks into a strip club alone in the middle of a Monday does so because they're looking for a good time. It's where people go to hide, where lonely people go to feel a little less lonely, even if they have to pay for it. On Thursdays, a stack of Now magazines would be dropped off at the lobby of our dorm. Now was very much like the Village Voice in New York, a free weekly paper with snarky editorials, ultra-liberal politics, in-depth artist interviews, and all the movie and concert listings for the entire week. Now was our Bible. We lived and planned our lives by that thing. The last few pages were all the same classifieds that most indie papers use to fund their operations. Buy and sell, missed connections, local business ads, and hundreds of listings for escorts, strip clubs, and chat lines. I'd never used a chat line before, but the ads were very provocative and over the top. They had names like Quest and the Night Exchange. Sexy anonymous fun for sexy anonymous strangers. The chat lines were always free for women, but men had to buy a $30 monthly membership. To get guys hooked, they did have a few free spots assigned to a separate phone number, and if you called and called and got lucky, you got in and were given 5 free minutes to chat. I didn't have a credit card, so I spent hours getting a busy signal before getting through. Those free 5 minutes would expire, I'd get kicked off, and I'd start all over again and again. Once you got through, you'd have to record your name and a quick personal greeting. This was all the women online would hear. You'd hit 3 on your phone to skip through the messages. You could press 2 to send a voice message, and pressing 1 would request a live one-on-one private conversation. Building enough of a connection and rapport while getting kicked off every 5 minutes made private conversations almost impossible. I'd get close, exchange a few flirty messages, say something personal, but not in any way true, and hope for the best. I'd only hear their names. The rest was up to me. The ultimate goal was to eventually talk live, exchange numbers, and call each other off the chat line for free. This would take hours of work, every single day, absolute dedication. I spent months waking up at 6 a.m. trying the chat lines until my first Radiolab class. Then I'd head out for spaghetti lunch at the strip club right after that, skip the rest of the day, and lie on my bed in my room trying to connect with someone. Anyone. Most nights, I'd fall asleep with the phone still jammed between my ear and the pillow, with my hand on the keypad after hitting redial a few hundred times. I was rarely myself on those things. It was always easier to be someone else, a fake name with a fake story and a fake life. I was used to that and always assumed the women were doing the same thing, so I never felt too bad about lying. On the chat lines, in that world, my name was Jack. And after much trial and error, I'd come up with the perfect 5-second greeting that almost guaranteed me a private message within seconds. I've never told anyone this before, and my God, is it embarrassing, mortifying. So let's all agree that you'll hear this one time and one time only, and you can never repeat it again because it's absolute cringe. But here it goes. Hey, this is Jack, just looking for a nice, warm voice to rub up against for a while. That was it. Fucking kill me. Eventually and inevitably, things escalated. I'd exchanged numbers with dozens, maybe even 50 or 60 women, and I'd spend almost every hour of the day missing class, locked in my room, talking to strangers. We'd have these incredible conversations that became less and less about sex. Little bits of truth would break through the characters that we'd created. I'd hear about their jobs, their horrible husbands, their broken marriages. We'd talk about our bodies, insecurities, and fantasies. We'd also laugh. We laughed a lot. This whole thing became an escape, and I became the thing they needed me to be. This was a connection, the thing I look most forward to in most of my days. In some weird backwards way, it felt like an audience. I was performing. These anonymous women saw something in me I didn't know existed, and I could be whatever it was they needed. And none of the women could see me. They couldn't see me tick or see anything else I wanted to hide. I had just turned 19, and these were the closest relationships I'd ever had. Once I started meeting women off the line, there was no going back. I'd sneak out of the dorm room way past curfew and take the bus into the city to meet up with someone my mother's age at a bougie downtown hotel. Or I'd head to a parking lot out near the airport and spend a few hours with someone else in the back of her minivan. I never felt more valued as a person than I did when I was there. Before your head starts spinning, no, I wasn't a teenage college gigolo. And no, I never took money. But everything was up for grabs. They saw something in me that was great, even if it wasn't true. It didn't have to be. I was whatever they needed, and I was goddamn good at it. For the most part, these were women who were alone or broken, who needed an escape from trying to hold it all together. And for me, it gave me purpose. I bought a secondhand suit in a vintage store for when I needed to be a bit fancy, and I picked up a bag of my old glam rock clothes from my parents' house for when I needed to be a bit more, well, that. Some dates lasted minutes, others the whole night. One woman found out I'd never been to Olive Garden and took me there for dinner every night for an entire week. Another, who I was meeting for coffee at noon, showed up drunk off her ass in an American flag bikini, took one look at me, and started throwing glass salt shakers at my head she grabbed off the hostess stand on her way in. I don't know what I did, but I sure as hell did something. But most nights, these meetings were exactly what you'd think they were. Sexy, anonymous fun for sexy, anonymous strangers. If that year taught me anything, it was that having a one-night stand can be awesome, but being a one-night stand feels pretty fucking awful. I was building a life around short-term, frivolous pleasure, torching the idea of any kind of long-term growth, and yet most nights I'd come home feeling great about myself, whether I was a shoulder to cry on or a body to climb on. If I felt like I helped or made any kind of difference, I was good. The other nights, though, the ones where I let them down, when I wasn't the exact thing they were expecting, or when I'd get dropped off in the middle of nowhere with no way home, on those nights, I head back to my room, flop on my tiny bed, and hit redial. In 2014, Humber College inducted me into the Radio Alumni Hall of Fame. New York Speed. I wound up in New York out of a combination of desperation, white lies, and jealousy. In the spring of 1994, during my last few months of that first year of college, I started working on this plan, this hustle, to get my ass to New York City. In order to graduate the radio program, you needed to complete 2 years plus an internship. The internship had to be approved and always came after your second year, never before. The other kids in my class hadn't even started thinking about an internship yet, but some of them were already getting job offers and leaving early, which enraged me. I was so jealous it caused anxiety, and I couldn't be happy for anyone. I'd avoid their goodbye parties at the pub, and I never offered up even a simple congrats or good job. Everyone was moving forward, evolving, and making shit happen. All their dreams were coming true, and I was fading, being left behind. I'd almost given up on the idea of stardom. This was now about survival. I knew at this point that if I was going to become anything, I'd have to learn from the best. I needed to surround myself with the smartest people who worked for the biggest shows. I needed to work for Howard Stern. I was still working for that rock radio station in Toronto on Saturday nights. The woman I was working for had been around forever, and she didn't give a fuck. She was pretty good at her job, but she'd smoke in the studio, take home records from the library and never return them, and spend hours of her shift talking to her boyfriends on the studio phone. She was messy, but we got along great. While the songs were playing, we'd have tons of time to just talk. And when you're sitting alone for that long together in a soundproof booth, you just start saying shit, opening up. Sometimes the conversation would get flirty and would usually end with her saying something like, "You should meet this friend of mine," or "I have the perfect woman for you." These quickly went from fun suggestions to blind dates I felt I couldn't get out of. The first one she set up was on a night when I should have been in working with her. She didn't so much ask as instruct me on the when and where. I couldn't tell her I was busy because she knew exactly what I did every single Saturday night. These women were all 10 or 15 years older than me, which was fine. I was used to that from the chat lines. But these dates were different. I had to be me. I wasn't a made-up character. I don't really remember much from those nights, except one started in a bar and quickly ended up at her place, and another woman openly referred to me as Young Bone while flirting across a table at a restaurant that I couldn't afford but still paid for anyway. I was insecure, and I didn't want to piss anyone off or let anyone down, so I went along with it. All of it. I'm sure my boss thought I was having the time of my life. To apply for an internship on the Howard Stern Show, you needed a resume, a cover letter, proof of college credit, and a signed recommendation from an industry professional. The cover letter and resume were a snap. My mom worked on these with me. Actually, she worked on my entire package with me. She was meticulous. She'd been working in an office for years by now and had seen hundreds of resumes come across her desk. Mine looked high-end and professional. She didn't even call it a resume. She wrote curriculum vitae up at the top, which looked fancy as hell. The letter of recommendation was another story. The only person I could ask was the DJ I worked with on Saturday nights, who, when I asked, said, "Should I add good in bed? Because that's what I hear." If there's one thing I've learned about that generation of DJs and that I've avoided becoming my entire career is that no matter what, everything is all about them, and my letter was no different. She knew this was going off to the Stern Show, so she filled it with horribly unfunny jokes, puns, and one-liners. She was auditioning. She called me poor, talked about my hair, and described me as someone she scooped up out of the gutter and said I only showed up to work for the free food. It was an embarrassing disaster. I handed my mom the letter to look over. This was the first time I ever heard my mother call another woman a bitch. She was livid and immediately started going to work on it. My mom was crafty as hell and had access to a laser printer. The first thing she did was cut out the station logo and signature with a razor blade. She saved those bits for later. Then she started firing questions at me, one right after another, as she sat at the family computer hammering out all my answers into my new letter. "What did you do there? Like, actually do?" she asked. "Played the CDs, turned on the mics. What else?" "Put stuff away, cleaned up, stuff like that." I certainly couldn't tell her that I spent the last few weeks sleeping with my boss's friends. "Okay, what did the other people do?" she shot back at me, waving her hand in front of my face like my two previous answers didn't count. "What are the other jobs? What did the other people do?" "I don't know, like the music director?" "What's that job? What do they do?" "The music director." "He's the one who picks and schedules all the music?" "Okay, you were the assistant to the music director," she insisted. "But I wasn't." "Just because you didn't do that job doesn't mean you couldn't do that job. What else? Who else did what?" She kept asking, so I kept answering. "You've given up every Saturday night for 2 years. For what? For this piece of shit?" She grabbed what was left of the original letter and swiped it off the side of the desk. "No, absolutely not. You're not getting screwed because some broad thinks she's funny." My mom took my new letter to work the next day and copied it all back together with the station logo and signature attached. It was perfect. A perfect forgery. And that's how I got my interview with the Howard Stern Show. My Uncle Gary, who wasn't really my uncle, was cool as hell, had a killer mustache, and was one of my dad's oldest and closest friends. More importantly, Uncle Gary drove for Greyhound and managed to score me a free bus ticket to New York for my interview. My parents sent me off with a little spending money and enough cash for a hotel room for one night, and anybody who knows anything about New York in the early 90s knows exactly what kind of hotel took cash without a credit card deposit, the shared bathroom, and no pillow kind. The first time I walked through those doors at the Port Authority bus terminal out onto 8th Avenue, I was hit with everything New York had to offer. I felt huge and anonymous all at the same time. It felt like home. At this point, Howard was still on K-Rock at 600 Madison Avenue. This was the same building Seinfeld used when Elaine worked at Pendant Publishing, and I recognized it right away. I was 10 minutes early for my interview, and I put my hair up in a ponytail before walking onto the elevator. As a fan of radio, walking into the studios where Howard did his show was shit your pants crazy. The show was on vacation that week, though, so the place was pretty dead. I met with a woman named Carol, who ran the intern program. She talked like a sassy New Yorker, and she reminded me of every great teacher I'd ever had. I loved her right away. Carol didn't want to know anything about my years of experience as an assistant to the music director or what my college grades were like. She just wanted to know what the hell I was doing there. The Stern Show wasn't even on in Canada, and she was blown away that a kid from Toronto would want to intern on the show. I had read Howard's book, seen all his appearances on Letterman, and knew that this was the biggest show in the world, even though I'd never heard a minute of it. She offered me the job on the spot, and I accepted on the spot. I was about to be Howard Stern's first Canadian intern. The only thing she needed was proof that I'd be getting college credit for it. I had zero intention of doing a second year of college, and I knew this opportunity probably wouldn't be available then anyway. So I had to convince my teachers this was a once-in-a-lifetime chance. I promised that they could hold all credit until after second year. If they hadn't agreed, I'm sure my mom would have forged that letter too. But they did, reluctantly, and signed off on everything. That was the last I ever saw that school. You never forget your first time in New York City. It's the most infectious place on earth. You don't ever visit New York. You try New York on, and it always fits perfectly. You know when a coworker comes back from one of those all-inclusive beach vacations with their hair still braided, a fresh tan, wearing a "Don't hassle me, I'm on island time" t-shirt? New York is like that too. It rubs off on you, and you want to take it home. But instead of turning up at the office in January, still wearing your sandals and a shell necklace, New York makes you want to just start telling people to fuck off. There's not a single person who ever visited New York that didn't take a little of that back home with them. That June, I packed up just about everything I owned, which wasn't much, and I moved to Manhattan. A friend from college, Alex, managed to score himself an internship in New York too, so his dad offered to drive us both. Alex was a good guy and had been to New York tons of times with his family, so he knew what was up. Me, I hadn't been anywhere, especially America. We were never a family that did weekend trips to Buffalo to hit up the outlet malls, and I was the only kid I knew whose parents never took him to Disney World. America was different in our house. It was always off the table. After my dad went AWOL following his second tour in Vietnam and came to Canada, he never went back. He was terrified. Even though they had long given amnesty to the draft dodgers, the guys who did serve but went AWOL were still subject to military disciplinary action. My dad was convinced that if he ever crossed the border, he'd be arrested. Alex and I moved into an apartment in the Village, right at Union Square and 14th. It was a one-bedroom that we shared with two other guys